creativity is just a thing that humans are thirsty for, even when we don't know that we're dying from the lack of it.
Hi, everyone. Welcome, and thank you for joining me. My name is Franco Vriano, and I'll be your host for the Tech Plus Art podcast. Tech Plus Art is the community for curious individuals and creators who are looking to make a dent in the universe. Together, we're exploring the new frontiers of creativity, humanity, and how emerging technologies will continue to shape our culture, professions, products, and much more. Join me on this journey as we speak with artists, makers, researchers, designers, and creators from all backgrounds and fields. Tech Plus Art is an inclusive community, and we make our content for you. So we want to hear from you. If you have any feedback, suggestions, topics you'd like us to explore or contribute to yourself, reach out to us on Twitter or via the website. You can check us out at maketechart.com or at maketechart everywhere else. So with that out of the way, let's get to today's episode. Today we're speaking with Kate Compton. Kate is an inventor, game designer, special effects artist, and independent researcher. She's also an academic with the Expressive Intelligence Studio at UC Santa Cruz, which is a group of researchers studying new ways of connecting computers and creativity. That includes everything from interactive storytelling to social simulations to laser-cut robots. Kate has been working on procedural content generation in a variety of contexts for over 10 years, from research papers like The Casual Creators to generative frameworks like Generominos to video games to Little Wild Experiments and more. I had an amazing conversation with Kate and really encourage you to check out her work online at galaxykate.com. So let's get to it. Hey, Kate, thanks so much for being on the show today.
Thanks for having me.
My pleasure. I'm really excited to, you know, get the chance to speak with you and learn a little bit more about you, your career path, and what you're up to. So let's dive into it. Can you tell us a little bit more about yourself? Where are you from and what was it like growing up?
Sure. I'm Kate Compton. I grew up in a combination of Ohio and Atlanta. Ohio, I was one town over from Bill Watterson, who drew Calvin and Hobbes. So my backyard looked a lot like Calvin and Hobbes.
No way.
Yeah. They don't show the hunters, though. We had a lot of poachers, so we weren't allowed to play out there unsupervised.
That's kind of cool and scary at the same time, yeah. I guess.
We're all Ohio, so it's probably only gotten better since the meth epidemic.
I can imagine. So you've created, written, and done a ton of stuff. Can you give us like a high-level overview of your career in that path so far?
Sure. Yeah, I've got like a little bit of a Forrest Gump style, been everywhere once. In 2000, I went to Pomona College down in LA. I was in the media studies department, which was at the time kind of a grab bag for people doing literature and media and Buffy the Vampire Slayer studies. And I started looking into how do video games tell us about things? How do they tell us about things in ways that aren't just what's displayed on screen? So how do the systems actually communicate things? And then from there, I went to Georgia Tech for 2 years of a master's program. And that was great. That was a bunch of really all-star people, names that may or may not make any sense to your audience. Michael Matias, Ian Bogost, and Janet Murray were all there. The people who are really at the forefront of what later kind of became known as procedural content generation, this idea that computers could generate things, or that you could write a program in a computer that makes things. And then from there, I saw Will Wright give a talk in, I guess it would have been 2005, 2006, presenting a game that was Spore, which hadn't come out yet. I got an internship on that. So Spore was the first big AAA game that was using generative content as the core of its gameplay, not just games like Diablo had used generative content before. Like, okay, we'll just kind of socket together some Lego pieces to create new levels. But Spore really used it all over the place. That was great. That really got me in the industry and in the industry doing what I was excited about and what very few other people could do at the time, which is write code that creates artistic or gameplay content, which is a whole trick in itself. Then eventually, after about 5 years of various canceled projects, I realized that I was slowly getting pigeonholed into a technical artist position, which is at Electronic Arts, which is where I was working. It's mostly you do little blood poofs and occasionally dust poofs. And I had met somebody who was working on the Godfather game at the time and was talking about his portfolio. It was like, yeah, I've done smoke poofs for this kind of machine gun and that kind of machine gun. And then I've done explosion poofs for these kinds of machine guns. It's like, oh, this is going to be my life. So I noped out of that and went back to grad school at UC Santa Cruz, which is, speaking of all-star programs, we're kind of overpowered at the moment, at least in especially games programs that specialize in this sort of procedural content generation. So we've got lots and lots of undergrads, but we've also got probably about, I don't know, 40 PhD students, maybe 10 faculty working in our department that are all doing like really cutting edge stuff, inventing kind of the future of what later gets filtered into things like Netflix's Bandersnatch.
Yeah, that's super cool. And so what got you started down this path? I mean, at what point did you realize that this procedural, you know, generation, generative media and like technology hybrid was a thing?
I guess I had two different paths. One of them was I used to build dollhouses all the time as a little kid. So I'd build like dollhouses and weird little dioramas, just like making these strange little worlds. And then I was doing computer science just because my whole family did computer science. It was kind of a thing that you do. And then when I went to college, I had this class where back in those days, and even most unexciting computer science departments, you spend a lot of your time sorting vectors of numbers. So here's a list of numbers. You're going to spend the next 4 years understanding how to sort them better and faster. And I had one class where they actually let us like make images on screen. And I did a for loop and I just had these randomly colored, randomly placed circles all over the screen, like just never ending. This moment that you get a lot in generative content where you turn on the faucet and it just starts going. And I just started cackling maniacally in the back of a computer science classroom because, you know, I had this amazing content that was just randomly colored circles, but it was magical. This sort of like the moment where you finally wave the magic wand and something comes out the other end.
That's super cool and exciting. And so tying those experiences together in the work, like somewhere along the way, recently you wrote a paper called The Casual Creator. Can you share more about some high-level elements of that thesis and how it fits into your work and some of the stuff you're doing today?
Yeah, Casual Creators is me trying to define an area of software. And this is an area of software that's like not new. This is an area of software that totally already exists, but nobody noticed it and gave it a name yet. And if you think about creativity software, you think about things like Maya and Photoshop, GarageBand, these things that can be used in professional situations. They can also be used by dedicated amateurs. You don't know what somebody is trying to make with them, so you give them all the tools to be able to make anything. So if you open up Unity, there's this terrifying array of buttons and menus in front of you because they don't know what you're going to make with Unity. They've got to just kind of unveil the entire horrifying possibility space before you, which is fine because if you're doing something because either your boss is paying you or you've got some grand artistic vision, you're willing to dedicate the time and attention to really slog through a difficult tool. And for a while, we thought this was what creativity tools were for, these kind of professional or virtuosic users. And it turns out there's this other group of users that need something very different from a creativity tool. And these users are using creativity. The term is called autotelic, which is Greek for its own purpose. If you've ever sat down and used a pottery wheel, it's usually not because you need a new plate. It's because there's pleasure in kind of digging your hands into the clay and seeing it take shape and like building it up and squashing it down and building it up again. You build sandcastles not because you need a castle in the sand, but because it's a pleasurable thing to do. And so there are all these users who like to do creativity for the process of creativity. And it turns out there's a whole different set of design principles if you're writing software for those folks. These are people who don't like a blank slate. One of the interesting things that I did during this dissertation was really go into the depth of what we know about creativity. And it turns out we don't really know a lot about like grand virtuosic creativity. We don't know that much about Beethoven, but we do know what does everyday creativity. Mostly we know that everybody is creative. And the important thing is not what makes people creative, because that seems to be just an inherent human need. But there are a lot of things that turn people off creatively. A big one is disgust. A really interesting thing, and I got to see this when we were doing a play test on one of the Spore offshoot projects. We had 8-year-old girls, 10-year-old girls, and 12-year-old girls come into a room and play this game and tell us what they thought. And 8-year-old girls were all bouncing off the walls, and they were throwing out ideas, maybe very playful with the product. The 10-year-old girls, about half of them were still doing that, and about half of them started getting really quiet. And the 12-year-old girls, nobody said anything. And this was because psychologically, between the ages of about 8 and 12, you realize that while you can physically do things, a lot of the things that you do are horrifying to your sociological group. So if you ask 6 or 8-year-olds, can you play, can you tell stories, can you sing, can you dance, they'll all say yes, because at that age, can you means are you physically able to? Do you know how to put a pen to a piece of paper? If you ask adults this, they've learned that can is not are you physically able to, but can you do so in a way that is sociologically approved? Hmm. And it turns out most people can't tell stories in a way that society approves of, or they can't draw in a way that is Instagram ready. So most people turn themselves off. And so a lot of what it takes to make a casual creator is just listening to other fields that have figured out ways to get people over this disgust, over this fear of a blank slate, and then just hard code a lot of those things directly into the programs.
That's super cool. And so how does that shift your approach of your research or the tools that you're trying to build for different audiences?
A lot of it is you make much smaller things. So if you have Unity, you need to be able to make any game. If you have Maya, you need to be able to make any 3D thing. If you're just trying to entertain somebody for 15 minutes, you might make something that's very specific, like a 3D printable teapot maker or something that just makes a weird little doodly bit of music. It doesn't even need to necessarily be anything good that it's making or something that you care about the product. One of my all-time favorites is called Super Sequin Simulator. If you've seen those pieces of fabric that have sequins on them that are two-sided, you can drag your fingers and flip the sequins. It just does that. This is something where it's just for the physical pleasure of using it. And so there tends to be a lot more focus on not having a lot of options available immediately. kind of getting people into a flow state, giving them small, frequent choices that they can make lots of these choices and change something. You're almost kind of more surfing than trying to get to a particular artifact that you're searching for.
That's super cool. And so another project that came along maybe about the same time, maybe a bit afterwards, was Generominos. I hope I'm saying that right, but I'm assuming it's kind of like dominoes, but okay, cool. So can you share more about that project and like what motivated that and what it's all about?
Yeah, Generominos were a design tool that I made. I keep meaning to like ship a box of them to Amazon so that more people can buy them. But you can go to galaxykate.com/generominos to see more about the project. And they're a deck of design cards that was me trying to puzzle out. There are all these different things. And like casual creators can be software on your iPhone. They can be like embedded inside of games. They can be in museums, sort of weird interactive museum exhibitions. I go to Burning Man, so they're in weird Burning Man art, weird installation art that lets you like kind of interact with it in some ways. And I was looking at all these different things, just hundreds and hundreds of these casual creators or interactive generative things in the world. And you're like, okay, how do they work? Sometimes somebody interacts with it, then the computer does something, and then an art comes out the other side. And then sometimes that art gets piped to other people who then interpret it in different ways, and then like the pipeline kind of keeps going. And so the Generominos were me trying to figure out an almost like Lego style way of having like, what are these things made out of? And they're made out of inputs and outputs. So you might have an input that's like moving a mouse, or you might have an input that's a webcam. And those inputs create some sort of data. And that data has different kinds of structure. So moving a mouse gives you an XY position that's changing, but then it also gives you events when you click the mouse. A webcam doesn't give you positions and it doesn't give you events. It gives you a big ever-changing bitmap of colors. And so then you have all these transformation cards that some of them can take like a big ever-changing bitmap of colors and find the edges and give you a different bitmap of colors that shows you where the edges are. Or maybe it'll find the faces and turn the faces into a vector position. So now you have a vector position and you can use that in the same way that you used a mouse. You can start using your face as a mouse. So anything that as an experience took a mouse before, now you can use a face. So yeah, it was really just kind of building these long pipelines, then looking at the different ways that people turn these pipelines into experiences. So there's a famous woman, Janelle Shane, who's doing all sorts of really exciting AI work. And she has this project called Skynet. And one of the fun things about Generominos is you can put humans and AIs kind of interspersed in the pipeline. It's not just like a human goes to a computer and then goes back to the same human. So Skynet, she took a whole bunch of knitting patterns. So asked the people of Ravelry.com, which is a social media site for knitters, said, give me all the knitting patterns you have. That bunch of random humans gave her those patterns. She then fed those into a neural network to try to make statistical guesses about what comes next in knitting patterns. Had that output a whole bunch more knitting patterns that were generated by the computer, again, just statistically, as all machine learning is. And then she gave those back to Ravelry. And the people of Ravelry, each one took a different pattern, started frantically knitting this thing that a computer said would probably knit something, and came up with these wonderful monstrosities, like just sort of scarves that tail off or have tentacles or tangle in on themselves. And then they would repost them and say, oh, look at the funny one that I found. And so yeah, that's something where it's like, here is a human and then a group of humans and then an AI all kind of playing together through the medium of these little programmatic knitting instructions and yarn. So this is something that diagrams out really, really well with Generominos, but it allows you to kind of play that game of like, oh, you know, here's a card, because all the cards have sockets, you're kind of socketing them together like Generominos. You could just throw them all out on the table, say, okay, well, here's the system that I thought I was building. Oh, look at all the other cards that socket onto there. Like, what would it mean if instead of playing Tetris with a keyboard, now we're playing it with a keyboard you can stand on? What if the person who's playing it is a non-human animal? Like, what if we're playing it somewhere illegal? What if the output is not on a screen, but on a window? You know, what if it's not on a window, but on a piece of clothing? So you can kind of just kind of socket stuff together very playfully.
Yeah, super cool. And so why did you start with cards, I guess, is a better question. Like, why did the Generominos fit into a card format?
There's a long history of design cards going back to, well, probably going back much farther than this, but the sort of famous one that kicked it off is Brian Eno's Oblique Strategies, which Brian Eno is a famous electronic musician, ambient / electronic experimental musician, with a classically trained background. And I forget who said it. It might have been Picasso, but it's like, when you're a child, it's very easy to paint like a child, but when you have training, it is very hard to paint like a child. And so as we become experts in things, we have these sort of pathways that we dig for ourselves. We like the paths that we walk become deeper and deeper, and it's harder and harder to get outside of what we know to be true and correct. And so if you have a deck of cards, you can play a random deck of cards you might not have chosen, but that card might push you outside of what you expected. And so things like the generominoes, you can physically put the, like, so cards have all these affordances. You can like draw one randomly. You can put two of them side by side. You can juxtapose them. You can have a table full of them and you can have friends sitting around that table, each looking at different cards and sort of like holding them up and flapping them at each other and saying like, this one, or like shoving others out of the way. So you can do all these playful, goofy things with cards that you can't do easily in software.
Yeah, exactly. It's faster. It's faster. But you're effectively like prototyping different outcomes with this playful element where all of a sudden, like kind of like you said, like, oh, what if it wasn't this? What if I, you know, instead of using a mouse, I'm using a different input. So how do you see those two projects fitting into your work and into this model of generative software and outcomes that people didn't expect?
Yeah, it's really about getting people to, I guess, Casual Creators is getting people to look carefully at these kind of generative interactive experiences. So a lot of them are considered trash software. So there's things like the Super Sequence Simulator that I mentioned. There's also a lot of like software for kids, software for girls, craft kits, sort of like you can do it yourself, paint by number kits, like physical ones. And these often get kind of wiped away as like not very interesting, or they're not deep, they're not meaningful, they're not real tools. The term real gets used a lot. And so it's looking at them, taking them seriously as a generative pipeline, and then also doing interventions on the generative pipeline whenever you want to change what's happening. And then also saying that like, no, Super Sequence Simulator is actually operating in a lot of the same ways that things like Team Lab, which is a group of Japanese artists that have blockbuster exhibitions all around the world, it's doing a lot of the same things that Team Lab is doing. It's also doing a lot of the same things that Brian Eno made a Casual Creator that's like a little music doodling app. It's like, it's doing a lot of the same things as like Brian Eno's app. These things are all part of a genre and they can all learn from each other. The same thing that you get from drawing a circle around what games are. It's like, why do I say that chess and football are both games? What do I get from saying that chess and football and League of Legends are all games? There's got to be something interesting that I can start saying about those. Like, oh, like I see that difficulty or challenge or confrontation is a part of some of these things. How does that interact with Tetris? Like, what does Tetris have to tell us about football? Can I do like fantasy League of Legends Tetris? Once you have all your toys together, you can break them apart into pieces and recombine them. And that's kind of what the generominoes gets you. It's like, now that I've got all of my casual creators in one big pile, let's break them apart into components and like rebuild them in just playful ways. It's like in the first Toy Story where that one kid takes apart all of his toys and builds them into monstrosities. But like those monstrosities are actually pretty cool. So like maybe it's more exciting to have a couple of monstrosities floating around than to be just given a Barbie doll and told that this is all the toys can ever be.
Yeah, absolutely. That's super interesting. And so again, over the course of your career, you've built a ton of stuff, not just, you know, papers and some of these frameworks, but like you've written software, you've done some of these things across a variety of spectrums. So I definitely encourage people to check out your website and we'll link to that so people can check out your project section and see some of the stuff that you've put there. But I guess out of all of those, what has been your most ambitious project to date?
I have lots of things that I haven't finished that are very ambitious projects.
That's true, yeah.
The one that's had the most reach is definitely a project called Tracery, which was originally a project that I did to not do a pencil and paper assignment by hand. I did eventually get a 110 on that assignment, so that was great. And I open sourced the software, and then somebody in England, George Buckingham, took that open source piece of software and turned it into a hosting site for Twitter bots. And what Tracery is basically it's a very super simple programming language, and like you can use programming language in quotation marks if you like. But what it is it's writing Mad Libs for computers. So if I want to make like a little grammar, which is like a little recipe, I want to make a little generative recipe for computer to generate infinite hipster cocktails. Like I want something that you can just like hit enter and get a new hipster cocktail generation. So it's like, okay, well, maybe let's see, a hipster cocktail needs a title, like the name of the drink. And then maybe it's a like a hashtag liquid and a hashtag liquid mixed in a hashtag container and garnished with a hashtag object. It's like, okay, now I need what a liquid is. Well, a liquid might be like an adjective and then some kind of drinkable things. It's like, okay, my adjectives are house-made, organic, free range, whatever. And my liquids might be orange juice and Kahlua and lemonade. And so eventually you fill out more and more of these lines in the Mad Lib and then you get like something. This is one of the first bots that somebody made with this is the hipster cocktail bot. And it does things like, you know, house-made Kahlua and free range vodka mixed in an old boot and garnished with a clock. And it's called like the Unimpressed Scooter. So there's roughly 10,000 of these bots currently on Twitter. Twitter is blocking a lot of them because of some sad, depressing politics that have nothing to do with these actual art bots. But people are still making these art bots. There's still about 10,000 of them running actively on Twitter. And yeah, it turns out there's all sorts of things that people want to make recipes for. So there's orcish insults, hipster cocktails. There's a great one that is a Dungeons and Dragons as though played in an IKEA.
Oh, no.
The Lufthansa hits you for 15 pine damage. Go to the cafeteria and eat 5 meatballs to regain health.
That's awesome. But, that's super cool.
All sorts of weird stuff that people have made. There's one called Infinite Screaming, which just screams. And it screams 3 times an hour, and it'll respond to you with screams. And it's one of the most popular bots on Twitter.
They would thrive on Twitter for sure. So given your experience like with the generative industry, and I'm just using that like super loosely, like what's your perspective on how it's evolved and what might still be missing? Where do you think it's headed?
Gosh, it's evolved so much. I mean, I've been doing this stuff on and off since I was a kid many, many, many years ago, but professionally since like give or take 2005. There are more tools than ever out there. So tracery is something very simple called a grammar that's been known about since like the 60s and common since the 80s and like was discarded in the 80s as not having any interesting affordances that computer scientists could actually use. But then it turns out if you put these too simple to be interesting tools in the hands of people, they'll turn them into all sorts of exciting stuff that like Infinite Scream isn't interesting technically, but it's very exciting like as a piece of drama, as a piece of art. The people have all sorts of little scenes that they'll set up with Infinite Scream. And we're seeing a lot of stuff now with things like generative adversarial network scans, all the sort of deep learning stuff, the GPT-2, which is popular. And these are things where it's like, okay, you can, if you think about these as Generomino's cards, you have a ton of data and then you dump that data into this deep learning thing and that gets you a model. And then you can feed single lines into the model and it'll try to predict the rest of it. Or you feed an image into the model and it'll try to like waggle the pixels until it looks more like a dog or whatever it's trying to approximate. And the nice thing about the Generomino's and like my work is that you can think about these things not as like a single magical thing where it's like, okay, we fed all of Shakespeare into a bot and now this bot makes really deeply trash Shakespeare that doesn't get anything of what we cared about Shakespeare, but it looks kind of like Shakespeare if you squint. And you could say like, oh, where do humans fit in? Like, how can we make a neat pipeline? And so like one of the most recent interesting things that somebody did with this is called AI Dungeons. It's a site that went down because he was paying $10,000 a day for hosting when it went viral. And he's just a student. So it's down at the moment, but people are making self-hosted versions. And the idea is that you have this thing that's been trained on, I think, some combination of like old school text adventure games. So it'll give you a little prompt and you can type whatever you want in response to that prompt. So you are in a dungeon. I say, I eat the dungeon. And then it'll come up with something statistically inferred from everything that it knows about the English language and what it's been fed. Again, just statistics, but like a giant Everest-sized pile of statistics to say like, you nibble around the edges of the dungeon and then eat its chewy caramel nougat center. And then you're like, what does the center taste like? And it's like, it is raspberry. It tastes like the sea. Like, where is the sea? And so you can just have these conversations. And this is somebody who's come up with a really clever way to use this super powerful tool and figure out what to do with it. And it turns out, like, again, when you're thinking about these things as pipelines that are all built out of Legos, people are taking old casual creators that were done with, like, previous forms of AI or previous forms of code and then saying, like, oh, well, what if we socket out this card for one that uses deep learning? There's a project called GAN Breeder. You have generative adversarial networks are things where it's, I've trained something to detect ducks and I've trained something to detect dogs. And then you can run that in reverse and say, okay, waggle the pixels of this image so that it is 100% dog or 100% duck. And then GAN Breeder lets you do things like, okay, well, give me an image that is 50% duck and 50% dog. And it'll do that. And then people can upload theirs and be like, oh, this one is really funny. And then somebody will be able to like make variants of that and make variants of that and make variants of that. But this is actually a rehash of a previous project by a different group of people called Pick Breeder, which did the same thing for much less interesting images about like 7 or 8 years ago. So this is like somebody who is kind of doing a riff on a previous one, but with new technology. Like the interaction style is the same. It's got the same, like you can upload your horrible monster with your name and then other people will make riffs on it. And like, you'll get this sort of whole wonderful little network effect of people bouncing off of each other creatively. But the tech has changed. It's a really exciting time just because we have these fantastic new tools, but nobody knows what to do with them yet. Aside to make really terrible headlines about how Shakespeare is obsolete now because we have computers.
So how do humans, AI, and creativity all mix together in this context? And why should we encourage more of this?
I think there's no art that's wasted. It's not that like some of these things will lead to grand things in the video game industry or like whatever like exciting hot Forbes 100 project is next. One of the things about creativity that I learned during the dissertation was when I was looking at like this sort of autotelic non-virtuosic creativity is like creativity is just a really important thing for humans. If you have incarcerated people being creative, they have less recidivism. If you have elderly people being creative together, they're less lonely. If you have injured people being creative, they heal faster. it turns out creativity is just a thing that humans are thirsty for, even when we don't know that we're dying from the lack of it. And so having people be creative through these weird doodly little things, even if it's Super Sequence Simulator, is important. Having people build small, weird apps that are pleasurable to them and a couple of other people is really interesting. I saw a great talk once as the opener of a game jam, which said, in a game jam, you're supposed to just make a game very quickly over about 2 days. It said, don't make the game that is going to compete with World of Warcraft or whatever it was at the time, the thing for millions and millions of people. Make a game as a love letter to one person. Find one person that you know that you want to delight and make a game that just delights them. And maybe it'll end up delighting them and three people like them, but that's okay. Not everything has to serve the world. We have so much fuss over 10x engineers and unicorns that, oh, we made this small thing and it turns out everybody needs to post 128 character messages to a random group of people. It's like, but no, there's a lot of room for software that is for small purposes, for small moments, for regular people. And I think that's really valuable. And I think we should be making more of that. Maybe some of it'll be exploration that we can like use later, but it's also just, you make a small painting of a tree and it's a small painting of a tree. And there've been a lot of other small paintings of the tree and that's fine.
Yeah, well said. I completely agree. And so if somebody was following a similar path to you, like what's one thing you wish you knew when you started that you would share with them? Or what's some advice that you would give to a younger version of yourself who's, you know, eagerly coming down this path of exploration and possibilities?
Yeah, gosh, lots of stuff. Finish more smaller projects. Don't try to make gargantuan things. I've made 100 projects and released them and maybe like three of them got any traction. And so if you don't release your 100th project, you don't know which of the three is going to, if you just make the first three and they're huge and they don't go anywhere, then that's kind of a loss. Learn new tools, apply new tools in different ways. All the walls between disciplines are invisible and not actually there, but we pretend that they are. There's no wall between art and science. I know Steve Jobs is famous for having taken a calligraphy course in college, and that's what caused him to realize what we think now is a very stupid fact, that fonts are important and computers should have them. And if you don't take weird humanities, liberal arts stuff, you lose out on a lot of the information about what humans are and what we value and what we care about that needs to be in software. Software isn't about sorting numbers. It's about sorting numbers that it does things that humans feel are important or are delighted by. Do you need to know humans before you make software for them?
Yeah, absolutely. A really, really good point. And so if we're to keep up with you, like, are there any upcoming projects or focuses that you're able to share? Anything we should stay tuned for? Like, what are you working on next?
Yeah, sure. I'm currently being supported by a really generous grant by the Center for Research in Open Source Software through UC Santa Cruz. They've been funding my work for this year, so through, I think, May. And I am currently making a human-free social network that's just for bots and putting your bots up and sharing your bots with other people. And that's at artbot.club. It's periodically up, and then I take it down because it turns out it's not actually done yet. But there should be something there eventually. I'm hoping that that'll be a new place for people to host weird bots.
That's super cool. That's awesome. All right. Well, we're going to have to stay tuned and see that, you know, come to fruition.
Mm-hmm. Thank you.
Awesome. Well, Kate, thank you so much for taking the time to chat with us today. It was amazing to have you on.
All right. Thanks so much.
Well, that's a wrap. Thank you for joining me for another episode of Tech Plus Art podcast. We're a very small team behind this project, so we greatly appreciate all your support. If you love our content and these podcasts, consider leaving us a review on Apple Podcasts and sharing it with a friend or two. This really does go a long way in helping us get discovered and reach more creators. As always, you can find us online at maketechart.com and at maketechart everywhere else. See you soon.